Then I'd like to speak for about 15 or 20 minutes on my experience in India. Well, I could talk for 15 hours. And then we will get into our second course, which is on the history of the Catholic Church. Well, first of all, I almost did not get to India because I left on January the 7th from the Metro Airport, and I was on the plane, TWA flight to New York, crowded plane, every seat occupied. We were told to get off the plane because no flights were landing in New York or leaving New York because of the weather. Came back to Detroit to the airport, and they told me the earliest I could get out would be in maybe 1 week, and not even sure because of the reservation already taken. Well, maybe God's providence, I did manage, with the help of one of the KLM officials. I asked Mother Teresa to write him a little note of thanks, so she did, to thank him for getting me to India. It's about 28 hours, a straight flight, 28 hours from Calcutta to Detroit. The impression that I got were more than just impressions, because for some 30 years I have been teaching the non-Christian religions, and quite a few of my students, correspondent education from the university in Chicago, have been people in India. Also, over the years I've taught some 30 of my own Jesuits from India. Then my great ambition was to go to India as a missionary. I was told I couldn't go because of my poor health. So 50 years later, 3 weeks. I went there for two reasons. One, of course, was to further organize the teaching of the Missionaries of Charity that I've been involved in now for 17 years. There are now around 3,400 members in the Missionaries of Charity throughout the world, and this year they have 500 novices. 500 novices. So my immediate and main reason was to organize a teaching program which has been mainly verbal until some years ago, traveling different parts of the country or different countries. But then some 7 years ago we organized an international home education program for studying the faith. And by now I'd say most of the sisters of Mother Teresa have at least got involved in the course, and the older one, of course, finished the program. But then what I also had done was to write what amounts to 4 volumes of explanations of the questions which they were being asked. The explanations of those 2,000 plus questions are now being published, and they will be available then for all the 500 some houses of the Mother Teresa sisters throughout the world. In the meantime, however, one of the purposes was to open the door to the teaching of the faith through the media, correspondence, radio, computer, recording, television. And Matt, Mother, and I spent quite some time discussing, because among the dominant, not just impressions, but conclusions that I came to were, first, that the Church's missionary work has been badly damaged by erroneous ideas now in missiology, as we're reading and studying in Catholic morality. And among the errors, of course, is the cliche that we are not to convert these Muslims or Hindus into becoming Catholics. Let them be good Hindus, good Muslims, good Buddhists. Karl Rahner, as you may know, is one of the, shall I say, evil geniuses behind that kind of thinking. As a result, the mission work in countries like India is surely a mission country, has been and is being heavily damaged. For example, I was informed, and I made my business to, get all the information I could while I was there. I was informed that the government has hired one of the outstanding Catholic priest teachers and media men to defend contraception on national India television. Where the average audience is 100 million. And you see what that does. Given the media, what can a missionary, as we say, somewhere in the wilds, as a country, even if he does somehow get across some Catholic teaching, if that same person comes into the cities or comes to know those who are more literate, that person's faith may be not distorted, at least badly damaged. So that the errors now in missiology have deeply and badly, adversely affected the Church's mission work. Again, what I found out, though I knew about it, but to get it firsthand and to see its effects right there, is that the government in India has, I would call it, a stranglehold on education. Well, the result is that, for example, you dare not teach the Catholic faith to those, say, who are not Christians or Catholics. Forbidden by law. And historically, the main person responsible for that was Mahatma Gandhi. And as we were also saying regarding morality, you just don't judge a person's moral character by somewhat slender line of his behavior or conduct. For example, we have a Jesuit college in Calcutta. It's called a college, but takes students from early grammar school years up to the equivalent of a third year in college in the States. They may not teach 1 hour of Catholic religion. Forbidden by the law. Well, in that connection, after I'd heard that from different sources, and towards the end of my stay, Mother Teresa asked me to speak to the whole community for about an hour one evening just on faith. And then she asked if I'd speak the following morning to the lay volunteers that come. I would see the average of around 50 to 70 always from all parts of the world in Calcutta working with these sisters. So I did. I spoke on faith. I'm not sure Mother Teresa expected this, but I gave my talk a double title. Faith, the foundation of charity, and charity, the witness of faith. And I explained that before you talk about charity, you better know what kind of charity you are identifying. There's charity in general, or there's Christian charity. And for that, you must have the faith. And then I further said that insofar as those who have the true faith, if they have it, they will witness to their faith by practicing authentic Christian charity. Well, what I learned is that so many people say come to India to practice, let's call it charity. And the needs are mind-boggling. There are not just one, but a number of homes for different needs of the sisters trying to meet. This is just in the city. In the city of Calcutta, for example, 6 homes for the dying. And now we say that casually, homes for the dying. Well, these are people picked up on the streets, or somebody, well, goes in search because they go in search of such people. And there they are, all on cots, each one to him or herself, men separated from the women. But they're all dying. And when you compare that to the United States, these are dying people. Medication? Where is it? And after a while, again, it just becomes so. That's the right word. So, inured to the pain, it's agonizing, but there they are. Then, see, there are so many homeless, starving people. And among those then whom the sisters get to help in those homes for the dying are those who just spend their time all day and far into the night making coffins. And then the factors contribute, well, planks of wood, different sizes, laying wooden coffins, or pile of coffins, waiting for those who will die to be buried. Then, homes for infants. And it would be under the age of 1. Same thing. Abandoned. First time that I've seen unsuccessful abortions. Child survived. There it is, it's alive. You can imagine what condition those children are in. And then for the infants, the sisters try to get some more competent help so it wouldn't be just casual lay volunteers, because those children can be in any condition physically. And of course, those who take charge of those babies, even to know or be able to recognize what possible sickness they may have or what their needs are. And so then a company donated their abandoned factory to the missionaries of charity. Perhaps 2 or 3 acres of building space. Every square foot covered with with people. Again, homeless, hungry. And then I visited, well, other places where they were taking care of people with certain disabilities. But all I can tell you is, once you've been there and you come to a country like the United States, and I mean this from the depths of my heart, we are living in a dream world. There are 800 million people. Among them, I saw some, and I was told about others, are many who are, even by American standards, well-to-do. But the majority are destitute. And consequently, the needs of these people are so great, so constant. I may have on some occasion mentioned to you the figures as far as the American Congress could come up with a figure reported in our Congress about the number of people in a given month who die of starvation or malnutrition in India every month. The average in that statistics was 100,000 a month. Well, the one thing that hit me every time I walked out of the streets, especially in the later evening and early morning, I had mass at the monastery, the mother house, at 6 in the morning. I either can celebrate mass with other priests or be the only celebrant. And, well, I'd have about a four block walk from where I was staying to the mother house. And there, people lying on the streets, on the sidewalks, and covered with rags or burlap, and you're never sure whether they're alive or dead. And then, because Calcutta does have its wealthy section too, but the people there, as I said, those who are, I won't even say well-to-do, walking in the streets, you know, matrons were there. They call it sari, is that what they call it? Sari. And beautiful color. So they just, in fact, they were animals too. But they'd be just walking over these bodies like they were animals. And early in the morning, or even very late at night. And you really have to walk on the street because so many of these bodies are on the sidewalks. And you don't want, especially at night, step unnecessarily on a human body. Well, when you see that firsthand and realize that behind it, if I can use that term, behind it is a philosophy. And that philosophy, in academic circles, we call non-Christian. What a platitude. What a platitude. In other words, and it's very much in context with our reflections on Christian morality. Those who don't have the truth of our faith, how could you expect them to respect human life? And even the theory, as it's called, of reincarnation. Oh, reincarnation. Having been there, I want to shout, reincarnation. What it means is, It is simply, on principle, an ideological desecration of the human person. Because their belief tells them that no single individual is, as we believe, a child that was conceived, born, lived for a number of years, the body dies, but the soul lives on. It is no surprise whatsoever when you come to the States that you have such widespread and wanton murder of the unborn. It is Christianity, and only Christianity, and only Christianity that recognizes the dignity and sanctity of the human person. Well, during the seminars which I gave, both to about 60 of the sisters, first was to the tertians who were awaiting their last vows, and the second group was of the juniors. They were on the first vows, but not all that could be rounded up in Calcutta were brought. And, I had 6 hours, a formal class every day, 6 hours. And believe me, they kept me busy. Was besides that, I had other things. I had conferences, I had confessions. My day began at 6 in the morning and finished at 7 in the evening. 13-hour day every day. Some dominant impressions. First of all, to repeat what I said before, you have to be in a non-Christian culture where Christianity is, you might say, prohibited by law. To begin to appreciate the treasure of our faith. And how, what word shall I use? Zealous is too mild. Militant. We should be to protect our faith. Allow no scoundrel, no matter what his position may be, I use the word scoundrel advisedly, to deprive anybody of this true faith, because in doing that, what you're doing, you're just, you are thereby de-Christianizing a society, in other words, paganizing, in other words, making that society inhuman in its treatment of human beings. One thing that I discussed at some length with Mother Teresa and with others too, of what can be done and even should be done to convert India to the Catholic faith. And I'm told, usually when the full chapel was, filled, maybe 400, 450 in chapel, no seats, of course, in the meeting or squatting as they do there. I told them, it is a shame, it's a disgrace, and even though I say it here in India, I don't mean just, we even mainly, you people in India, that 19 centuries after Thomas the Apostle came to India, less than 2% of India should even be nominally Christian. That's a scandal. And I said, there's one remedy. It's what it was in the early church and has to be today. India needs martyrs. So one day during class, I came back to the subject. How many of you sisters in class want to be martyrs? Well, 10 hands went up. How many want to be martyrs? Another 10 showed up. How many will pray for martyrdom? I don't think I got them all to put up their hands. But behind the martyrdom, as I told them, and made sure that Mother Teresa was also there when I said certain things. Can you imagine St. Paul? Just imagine St. Paul not proclaiming Christ because the Roman Empire was against Christianity. Oh, what a blink. So what? Tell me something new. But then, I thought I would share this with you too. It's a disgrace. The condition of the Catholic Church in our country is a scandal. And what aggravates the scandal, as it does in India, is that the very ones who should be, well, witnesses to the best of Christian morality are counter-witnesses living dissolute lives. As Xavier said back in the 16th century, there's only one obstacle to converting India. And he baptized 100,000 people with his own hands in the 10 years that he survived. It killed him. My main obstacle converting India is the conduct of so many Catholics, especially among bishops, priests, and religious. Amen. Amen. So, and I was going to speak for 15 minutes, wasn't I? Well, of course, I could say much more, but I think I will go on to our class. First of all, you should all have a copy of that IQ Church History quiz. I repeat, must be for the fourth time. Take the quiz, sign it, turn it in. I will return it, by the way, with your grade. For your growth in humility. But it's both informative and useful for me to know what I should stress, because we're dealing this semester with 1,500 years of Christian history. First then, to read, and read, I would say religiously, read the pages assigned. Most Catholics have only, if that, a bird's eye knowledge of the history of the Church. What I thought I would do today, before you even have all the books in your hands, I think I would give you some reasons for the knowledge of the Church's history is not only important or valuable, but I would even say necessary. I've numbered my reasons. I like to save some time for questions. What time do you finish class? Is it 4? 4:15. Maybe then go for about a half an hour. Are these all the questions, or are there some more questions? Are there more there? Okay. I may not go through all of these, go for till about a quarter of four, then I can pick up with where I've left off and then also answer some of the questions. Thank you. Reasons why the study of the Catholic Church's history is so necessary for a Catholic. First of all, to really be convinced of the Church's credibility. You know what credibility means? Credibility means a rational foundation for believing that something is true. The rational foundation for believing that the Catholic Church is true, as we know, there are usually given four principal marks or signs of credibility. She is one, holy, Catholic, and apostolic. First of all, the Church's unity. I cannot tell you how important that is today. When geographically, surely in our country, geographically, there is such widespread disunity. In other words, the first mark of her being the true Church, namely her unity, is not just weakened, but positively destroyed by the growing and the deep disunity. Geographically, I don't mean just say of a nation, even in a given diocese. Consequently, by seeing the Church's history, you see that she has maintained her unity. Unity in faith. Christ's divinity. Mary's divine maternity. The real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. The indissolubility of Christian marriage. Just to read that part of the Church's history in the 16th century. There a woman by the name of Anne Boleyn, a mistress of Henry VIII, told Henry, now, that's enough. No more sex, Henry, unless I become queen. And Henry gave in. And the result has been millions of souls have been damaged. And the Catholic Church destroyed in many parts of the world. And yet, how the Church stood firm on marital indissolubility. As I told Cardinal Connors, I think I've told you, Mother Teresa was there. What America needs is more bishops like St. John Fisher. Remember? The only bishop who withstood Henry VIII. All the others caved in. To read how the unity of the Church in her faith and in her morality remained constant, even though many fell away, there were apostates. And the most disastrous were the apostate bishops. But the Church remained one in doctrine, one in her loyalty to Jesus Christ. The Church's holiness. Depending on how many people you know and how widespread your reading of contemporary Catholic thought, you might wonder about all this holiness of the Catholic Church. Would you please let me know where I can find a holy person? But the Church's history then will show that even in the worst ages, in fact, especially in the worst ages of the Church's history, the worst immorality. There were, you might use a divine balance, some of the church's greatest saints. That's why there's no question what the church mainly needs today is more saints. Catholic, everywhere. By the end of the first century, the faith had been already, remember, proclaimed as far west as Spain, as far east as India. And just for the record, after 19 centuries, the strongest Catholics in India are those who go back to St. Thomas. And when we have parishes closing, dioceses becoming extinct, almost 2,000 extinct dioceses in the Catholic Church. And by the way, America is increasing in the number of potentially extinct dioceses, because nobody told you. To realize that the church had been firmly established and remained strong. But there's one thing that you'll learn from the church's history is the truth of Christ's words. Except for the cross, you are my disciples if you carry your cross every day. And love it. Then, apostolicity. In other words, loyalty to the Bishop of Rome. Again, over the centuries, wherever and insofar as the Bishop of Rome and his authority were respected, there, and I would add only there, had the church even survived, and I would add thrived. So that we can almost predict, we drop the other, almost, we can't predict. The history of the Catholic Church in the 21st century. Infallible prediction. The Church of the 21st century will be only as strong as those in any part of the world, any part of our country, are still loyal and faithful to the successor of St. Peter. The church weakens, shakes, and dies. Except where the Roman primacy remains strong. In other words, we can't predict the future of a country like ours, and within this country, a diocese like ours. As by now, 23 years in working for the Holy See, I can predict the future of religious institutes. Their loyalty to the Bishop of Rome, obedient to his teaching, determines their stability. And those then that are not faithful to or ignore the authority of the Bishop of Rome, their days are numbered. The church's history teaches us how true is the present Holy Father's statement that the normal condition of the church is one of persecution. So much so that if the church is not being persecuted somewhere, look around. There's something wrong. There's something wrong. In other words, if Christ, incarnate truth, from within weeks of his birth, is already haunted to death and saved only by a miracle, then finally survived 3 years. Some people wonder why Christ's public ministry was only 3 years long. Only 3 years long. Christ decided he could have, of course, extended it to 6 years or 9 years. But if his fellow Nazarenes had their way, he would have been killed, remember? When he first spoke in the synagogue. And I repeat what I said before, but I want to emphasize. And I want to be as kind as I can in understanding. But I must say it. We are, I have to say it, cowards. We are afraid. We are scared. What is first person plural? I include myself. Oh, the devious ways, the clever ways we can, well, present ourselves as Catholic and all kinds of congenial friends, and I don't get this persecution business. Seems to me it's some kind of a psychopathological complex. No complex, my friends. No complex. Persecution. Then, martyrdom. As I told the people in India, and I will just repeat here, that what the fathers of the church said now, the blood of martyrs is the seed of the church. It's not a clever phrase. If we take that statement literally, and the church has canonized it over the centuries, and it means you must have martyrs, right? Otherwise, the church will not grow. And the church has had martyrs in every century, including ours. There are some 3,000 Jesuits in Spain. That's why my great hope for the Society of Jesus. We'll make it. We'll make it. Then, Reformation. Whatever else the history of the church will teach us, it is, and where the church is established in a given part of the world, well, often at the price of martyrdom. The first converts, oh, zealous. Can't do enough to show their love for Christ. Zealous in promoting the faith. Then as numbers increase, and the variety of members of the church increase, timidity steps in or walks in, and after timidity, then immorality, and immorality not only in conduct, but the coined word immorality in doctrine. In other words, the church has regularly needed reformation. And then one of two things happens. This is the church's history. Either in that part of the world at that time, there was indeed a reformation both in doctrine and in morals, or the church died out. And of course, there can be no reformation without reformers. And they are people who are deeply convinced of their faith, prudent, even shrewd, but zealous, and not afraid. Not afraid of what people will think of them, not afraid of, well, the last thing that the church's great apostles ever did was to use Dale Carnegie as a model for influencing people, always with great charity. And I think I should share this with you. I had heard this before, had read it, maybe even wrote it somewhere, that among the Hindus, they have a great respect for whatever you want to call them, their spiritual leaders, gurus, whatever. Well, I figured I'm going to India, so from morning till night, I'm going to be, like a Jesuit should be. So I wore my black cassock everywhere. I was going to one of the places where the missionaries of charity were hosting some guests. All from India, but all looked like professional people. And none, as far as I could tell, and I was told, Christians.